What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Till your body okay. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
The Hypnoga.
Boom, episode 176 of Talking Bollocks, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, Terry Flower.
It's me, COB.
And this week we're joined by...
Mark Megan.
Mark, what's the crack? How are you?
How are you, lads? I'm very good. Thank you for having me.
Come here, Mark. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Jesus, that's...
Why you're in here? Why you're in here? So,
okay, well, you read my book.
Yeah.
You read my book.
And we're big fans of the book, by the way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah, so I'm here because I wrote a book, released a book, which is called This Is Not a Self-Help Book. It came out March 14th, and the book is about me getting sober, basically.
Mm.
But goes back a little bit beyond that as well. Because by trade, I'm a comedian. I've lived a couple of lives, but primarily I'm a comedian after, you know, trying my hand at music. I'm sort of also in recovery after trying to make it as a musician. And here I am, yeah, so I suppose that's why I'm here. We're both part of the Go Loud roster. I've obviously got my podcast, The Weekly Roast, with Kieran in Go Loud.
So people think that like there's some obligation that once you start a podcast with Go Loud, you have to do the other podcast and Go Loud.
Yeah, I'm yet to be on Hold My Drink. Is that
that's next?
Someone send Charlene an email.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like we said, two of us have read your book, and I'm a huge fan. Like, I couldn't believe how good the book was because I didn't really know much about you.
Mm.
So we got the book and I read it. And one of my favourite things about the whole book is early on in the book, you understand your place of privilege and still speak about how it doesn't matter where you're from, you can still end up down that road. And I was a huge fan of it. I read that when I was away. I actually texted it at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking straight away, going on to Calvin, I was like, I think it was already in the works, wasn't it? Getting Mark onto the podcast.
May have been.
But have you read it as well?
I'm in the middle of it.
You haven't finished it?
Haven't finished it yet, no.
It does get better towards the end.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
No, but is it true that you didn't send out many copies of that book?
Yeah, I was really weird about it. And thanks for the kind words. I mean, I remember getting your message. I was in the Jacks and I screenshotted it. Genuinely, I screenshotted it straight away and I sent it there and I was like, fucking legend, how nice is that? Because for me, getting messages from people about the book and or just in general talking about recovery, because there's such a sense of imposter syndrome and like a fear that it looks like I'm speaking to anybody else's experience other than my own, you know, because that's, I don't have any authority on addiction. And when I got your message, somebody else who doesn't drink, for them to identify with your story is just, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. So in this podcast, Mark, we do is English. Have you ever listened to an episode of the podcast?
No, I actually haven't. But years ago, during COVID, somebody called me out on Instagram, was like, you're trying to rip off the Talking Bollocks lads. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Because I put something up on Instagram where people were they were saying, what do you call the remote?
Yeah.
Do you call the remote the box or the buttons or the whatever? So I just started doing a series of them. And then people said I was ripping you lads off.
So there you go. So plagiarising.
Whoever that was, fair plagiarism.
Yeah. That one lawyer.
Yeah. Who the fuck are MTV? Yeah.
They had good taste back then.
Yeah. So that's basically how we started this podcast
with
them. And as you said, there was an appetite for it during COVID and people just stretched their out. I mean, we have scraped through the bottom of the barrel at this stage when it comes to this.
So is the whole premise just, what do you call this thing?
Or would you rather?
Oh, excellent. Okay.
We're single in
176 episodes.
So last week we come up with one after a long time, and it was Crips, jellies, chocolate. One of them has to go.
Crips, jellies, or chocolate. Crisps are gone.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Crisps are gone.
That was very quick, Mark.
I could eat jellies, and I do eat jellies. It's since I quit smoking, it's been the biggest disaster is jellies.
Mm.
You get this out. Do you either? Yeah, you smoke, don't you?
Yeah, I smoke, yeah.
Yeah.
I still love jellies, though.
You can do both.
Yeah.
That was like, when I was trying to quit smoking, I went on Juuls for a while.
What's Juuls?
Juuls were like this American vape you could get. It's like a really thin one. It's just a type of vape, but it's like, it was really neat sort of, and it was strong. It was like 20 milligrams, but I'd be hitting the Juul in bed and around the gaff and then going out and smoking as well. I fucking love smoking.
Don't talk to me about a place.
Do you have any plans to give them up?
Plans?
Yeah.
We've literally exhausted all options.
Mad
Heat Party had 100% record of getting people off the smokes through hypnotising. brought Terence into this building, hypnotised him, and he walked home having a smoke.
Are you joking me?
Yeah, I don't know why.
He rang me on FaceTime on the way home, and he's like, I don't know what's had to happen. He's at the fuck of my head up, I'm getting mad visions. And he's holding the phone in this hand, and a smoke in the other hand, and he's smoking on the phone.
What did Keith Barry promise you?
He literally just rang me one day and he was like, do you want to go off the smokes? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, right, come over to Marconi House Thursday, 12 o'clock.
What?
Brought me in. Now, whatever he was doing was walking.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's not this, like, it's so hard to explain. I was just having all these mad visions and I did feel a bit like, oh, there's something fucking happening here. But when I left, I was just all over the
And were you, were you doing lots of breathing stuff?
Yeah, there was breathing stuff.
Because I went to a hypnotist, I went to a hypnotist before my first live shows. Because I suffer from crippling, like, panic attacks and anxiety. But, like, panic attacks are the most sort of, the biggest barrier to entry when it comes to going on stage and stuff. So when I did my first live shows, I was only 6 months sober, and I was like, there's just no way. There's no fucking way I'll be able to go out on stage. And I was like trying everything, Googling everything. And then I was like, fuck it, I'll try I found this guy, his name was the Celebrity Hypnotist, but that's just what he had called himself. Do you know what I mean? No, he had never had any like celebrity clients. It was like Greg from Kent. So anyway, I messaged him and I was like, I need to go on stage. And he was, I sat down, I did two or three lessons with him. And similar to yourself, I went in and I told him, I was like, I'm the most cynical person. Because to be brutally honest, like, when it comes to hypnotism and stuff, I'll always remember one time sort of watching TV with somebody. And it was Sunday night, okay, and Dynamo was on.
Mm.
And Dynamo, who's like mentalist magician.
Basically but he also, English David Blaine, isn't he?
Exactly, yeah. And so Dynamo was doing this thing where he teleports himself from the roof of one building to the roof of another. In London, in like St. Pancras or something. And the person I was watching TV with was like, now, Mark, I know you're very cynical. Do you think that's fake? And I was like, if this was real, why is it on Dave Plus One at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night? Do you know what I mean? Surely this would be on the fucking news if somebody has discovered the ability to actually teleport themselves. So like, in that way, when it comes to like mind reading and hypnotherapy, I'm like, if this was real, like, would it not be bigger? Like, You know those rocks that people are into?
Crystals, yeah.
Well, like, crystals are rocks. It's like, where'd you get them? Oh, I got them in a market down in Valencia Island on the weekend. Yeah. Did you,
yeah?
Would they not be making more, like, retail? Like, would they not be in a position in a bigger shop than, like, the back of a car boot sale in Valencia Island if these rocks can help you, like, be clairvoyant?
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, I went and did the hypnotherapy and it worked. I'm curious.
After all that, fucking filled up the balloon and just busted it.
No, genuinely, it actually, similar to yourself, I believe it's in the breath, though.
Yeah.
I believe it all centers from whatever way you tap into that deep breathing, that it centers the head in a way that nothing else does, for me anyway.
He'd said to you that he's going to make it that when you start smoking, you're going to, horrible thoughts are going to go through your head. Like the worst thoughts imaginable to your head, like stuff that's going to happen bad to you and your family if you smoke. And Terence walked home smoking.
And did you have any of those thoughts?
No.
See, if you have enough bad thoughts anyway, it's hard to differentiate.
Doesn't get any worse.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but he sent me, he recorded it as well, and he sent me the recording. So I was meant to listen to that every day.
Yeah.
But come on.
Discipline, there you go.
Do you know what I mean? 30 minutes or something every day. That Dynamo, how did he transport though? How did he teleport?
I think they just went like, yeah, got you there, and cut. Now we'll just, yeah, we'll get him down.
Do you reckon he's in the did lift. That though?
Yeah, but what's the alternative?
How else? No,
what's the alternative? That he teleported, of course.
No, but I mean,
he didn't fly.
I remember he done one during the World Cup. And he was like, he was going to predict, like, a player getting injured, top scorer, and the winner. And it was like,
the octopus did it better in the end.
Yeah, really. Like, he had him on Sky Sports News on, like, the opening ceremony, and then he brought him back on the day before the final. And he's like, oh, here's these envelopes that you left here. Oh, no way, you got that one right. Oh, yeah, sound pal, yeah, pull the other one. Like,
oh, you know it's wild.
Crazy. And he's supposed to predict the lotto numbers and all. No, that wasn't him. What's your other fella's name? You know your man.
He convinced Darren Brown.
Yeah.
But it's Darren Brown. But Darren Brown's the guy that sort of breaks them down and says, this is what I, you know.
He got someone to fucking rob a bank and murder someone.
Remember he got your man to push the fella off the roof? Did you ever see that one?
No. Yeah, I did, yeah.
Like, he convinces these people that, like, they're working on some gig and it's a catering gig for a big client and everything keeps fucking up.
Yeah.
But basically, you are at the ruin this person's day so much that they're at fucking rock bottom.
Okay.
They have no other option. to make the, everything better here. They need to get rid of the fella that aren't pissing off so much. So yeah, man pretends to have a heart attack and you're like, if you fuck that body into the freezer and we'll just pretend nothing happened, and they do that, but your man's not really dead, obviously. And your man gets out of the freezer, pissed off, and goes to have a smoke. And he's like, you'll hear from my solicitor now, blah, blah, blah. And he's standing on the edge of the roof. He's really clipped into the roof.
Oh, jeez.
And your man is like, the fella, if you just push him off that and it makes it look like he fell, it's the same thing as when we had him in the freezer. And then, like, it shows you these people going over and pushing him. And obviously, your man doesn't die. But then I'm like, but it still shows me that you had the intent of murdering that fella.
But this is the whole thing when you hear it's like, oh, Dermot Malone. Not that that's actually, that is a person I know. Dermot, you're innocent. But like, you know what it's like? Oh, Dermot Malone was found guilty of attempted murder, so he's only given 3.5 years. Just because he failed. You know what I mean? Just because he didn't succeed in what he was trying to do, shouldn't get less time.
Should get more.
More, yeah, for being inefficient at the fucking gig.
But like, these mad cunts are out there doing shit like that, and people are like, do you reckon that was real? And do you reckon that was real? And fucking David Blaine.
But they put their names and all on the screen. They're like Annette McLaughlin.
Yeah,
oh, this was her.
But that has to be, they have to be plants, because I don't know. Would you not, if, okay, so for instance, if you did discover that you had the ability to either read minds or manipulate people to the extent, how come that they seek fame rather than something more sinister?
Mm.
Or are those people out there and we don't know?
Yeah. I don't know, it was mad shit. Like David Blaine doing the bullet catch and all that shit. Like,
yeah,
people, like, oh, do you reckon he's
what
doing
what bullet catch?
Someone shoots a gun at him, you catch a bullet. And it's,
yeah, he watched The Matrix well, 3 times.
You know what I mean? And people, but this is what I don't get. Like, where do you stop with that shit? Like, oh, he can read minds, the crystals, everything
that's
else.
It.
And I'm like,
you see, that's it. It's the, it's, I would be the exact same. Because if you're going to believe in this, you're sort of, you know, it's like whenever, and I'll be shot for saying this, but you know, whenever, like, you'd be talking to someone, they go, oh, I was lying out in the garden there the other day and the clouds just formed into this lovely shape. And I know that was like, you know,
yeah,
whoever, and I go,
yeah,
really, yeah?
Yeah. But anyways, parents are still smoking and Mark isn't. So there you go. You need to go on to the celebrity hypnotist.
You have to just, I think it's, and I'd almost say smoking, by the way, is, I don't want to say harder than drink or drugs, but it's different. Because like, for me anyway, with drink and thing, there's that, like, there's the whole, you know, which we could talk about, the sort of the desperation, the moment of surrender and just like,
yeah.
But with cigarettes, it's this like, it's just this primal fucking instinct of get it into me, get it into me. I like, it's like your skin crawls.
With drink and drugs, the way I'd look at it is with drink and drugs, it literally brings you to your knees. You're at breaking point and you're just, you're at your lowest you can be.
Yeah.
And everybody who was an addict will get there and has been there. And
we're
smoking. Is it going to be that until someone says, like, it's terminal? Yeah, fuck.
But
like,
you still have people smoking outside hospitals, like.
I think that now I'm like, if someone said that, like, I'd probably still smoke, like.
Well,
like,
what with the health check?
Well, when I was off the smokes for 4 or 5 days, was it?
I think that's a bit of a stretch, but go on.
No, well, what? It was about 4 days. Yeah, we won't say 4 days.
And were you sick?
Oh, no. I booked the health check. I got off the smokes.
You got the full NCT done.
Man. Okay.
Yeah, I got the whole walks done. And I just wanted to be healthy. Do you get me? Fucking, I'm stopping everything and whatever. And I got the health check and whatever. And I went into your man and he says, yeah, so you're doing all this where you're blowing in and it checks your lung capacity and all this carry on. Mm. So we went to the room and he's like, I see here you smoke 25 a day. And I went, yeah, my lungs are fucked, daddy. And he goes, no, they're absolutely perfect, actually. So, but they're bad for you, like. And I was like, so there's no issues with the lungs, no. Yeah.
So you went back on the smokes then.
Went down, bought 20 blue.
I said,
what am I stopping for? They're in good nick.
I can relate that. I would smoke, even now, I'm like a year and a half off them. The first time anything irritates me, there's this thing in my head that just goes, fuck it, buy a pack of smokes.
Yeah.
It's my response to everything, buy a pack of smokes.
And do you love the smell of smoke?
It's weird the way some days trigger you, some days don't. Some days I walk beside a boozer and you go, oh, what could have been? But then other times you're not even aware that it's there.
Mm.
You know, similar enough with smoking.
Like, where, I've always loved the smell of someone lighting up a smoke.
Yeah.
Like, since the start of time, I've loved that smell. And even, I was off the smokes before a few years ago, about 8 months.
Did you do 8 months completely cold turkey?
No smoking. 8 months off them. But I stopped everything at that time. So drink, drugs, smoking, gambling, everything got stopped at the same time. So that was a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
But even when I was off for the 8 months, I'd be walking down the road and someone would be smoking. I'd be going, I fucking love a smoke.
Yeah. I think you love the habit of smoking as well. Like that. So he had a smoke before the podcast started. Yeah. You'll have another one then the second you leave here. Yeah, yeah. You go out and have another one.
Yeah.
But like you take that away from him, what does he do?
Well, that, by the way, that's for me, like when I quit smoking, it almost presented a big problem in my recovery from drinking drugs. Because I didn't realise that I was using cigarettes to bookend every single emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that. It was, okay, you're going in somewhere, have it. But then when I'm sitting here now, if I was nervous, I'd be thinking, well, just get to that cigarette. You know, my day was just a series of going from
cigarette.
It's
like a reward.
It's just that everything's a transaction. Go in, do this, get the reward afterwards, then do that. Then you get the reward. So then once that was gone, and it was really gone, then it was like, literally, what the fuck am I? Because you're not even having those 5 minute reflections to yourself. Because there are benefits to smoking in terms of the ritual, I think, probably of going out and taking a moment by yourself,
yeah,
and just like collecting. You know, you're going into a restaurant. It's intense. It's busy. You know, you arrive. Everyone's finding their table. You go, I'm going to step out for a smoke. You go out. You breathe, albeit carbon monoxide and
everything else. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, but
yeah. But even at that time as well, I didn't even realize. At the time when I had given them up for the 8 months, that time, like I said, I'd given up everything at once. Yeah. I was like, whoa, it's a big shock. Yeah. But I didn't realize, I was drinking 8, 9, 10 coffees a day.
Yeah.
And my brothers, but I didn't realize that, like, is a substitute. Yeah. I was just like, I love coffee.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was just so, like, uneducated with it all. And my brothers and all would be saying to me, like, you need to stop drinking coffee. I was like, I stopped drinking, I stopped smoking, I stopped doing drugs.
They need to bring out, and I can't even have a coffee. Like, you know what? Like, the alternative to the drinking is you get a non-alcoholic version of the drink and you still do the ritual. You still go to the pub, you can still pour a pint, you can still have a few
And do
bowls.
You do that?
I do that.
Okay.
But not very often. Do you know what? I don't even go to the pub very often anymore.
Yeah.
Like, the last year or so, like, I've had 2 relapses
since
I stopped drinking 4 years ago. Okay, yeah.
Well done.
So, 2 slips in the meantime.
Yeah.
But I've always been in the pubs as well. I'm not saying that's the reason why I slipped.
Yeah.
But I've always been in the pubs. But the last, like, couple of months, 6 months to a year, I'd say, I just don't really even enjoy the atmosphere anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you're in my head, if I'm not going and I'm not doing a bet and I'm not having a drink and a snap, I don't really... I don't get it.
Someone said to me at the beginning, they were like, if you, you know, and lots of people have heard this, but it's like, if you hang around barbers too long, eventually you'll get your hair cut.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. No. I'd...
72 hours for me. Just lock yourself in a room for 72 hours and fucking pray to a God if you have one and just don't do anything else other than not smoke. And for me, it was like getting over those first 3 days.
Yeah.
That's what put him off going away, because he knew he'd have to go 8 hours without smoking.
Yeah.
Fuck. Serious though.
Yeah.
Serious. And it was a fucking killer. That's what also made me want to stop, was like, I didn't realise how much I had a hold of my life until I was on a plane and I can't smoke and I have smokes on me.
Yeah.
I was like, I like a smoke here, handy.
I'd vape in the bathroom and stuff.
Mm.
Rock and roll.
I've seen people do a lot worse in the bathroom.
Yeah,
don't worry.
I'd give up Crips as well, by the way.
Would you?
Yeah.
Chocolate's gone. Chocolate's gone for me. I've thought about this long and hard enough that chocolate's gone. There's so much varieties of Crips for me. Flavours, shapes, manufacturers, everything.
Doritos and a chili.
Doritos,
dip.
Pringles, Hunky Dorys, normal Tato, Skips. All the different flavours.
Skips. We then you Skips have, at home at the moment.
Oh,
then you have the old skill ones like Skips, Meanies, Hula Hoops.
Yeah. Rancheros.
All this shit. Are you giving up all that, lads?
Okay, here's one for you. You've probably been asked this on your zingers already. If you could have free food from one restaurant for the rest of your life in Dublin, where would it be?
San Sab Drumcondra.
Can't sound familiar.
They've opened a new one up in, I think, Black Rock, and there's one in Clontarf as well.
Are they giving you a free grub?
No, and I'm trying to get fucking free grub.
Is this SpawnCon now or something?
Yeah, oh, I swear on? To God.
He mentions them every week.
Mark, I'm addicted to it.
Really?
Is
it?
It's a Thai restaurant.
Okay.
But I mean, we will not eat out of anywhere.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, yeah.
We won't eat out of anywhere else. Like, that's the only place me and the missus will go to. And I mean, I got to a stage there before Christmas, we were going nearly 4 days a week. And I used to just go in and say, I can't pronounce most of the dishes on it. They're all like Thai dishes. And I'll just point. I said, give us that. And then the next time we go back, I'll just walk my way down the menu. Every single thing, just keep walking through the whole thing.
That's mad that you're actually open to trying that many different dishes. That's great.
I had guinea pig in Peru.
Did you?
Yeah.
How was it?
Sure, it tastes like chicken. Your mum was like, oh, this is unbelievable. It's not like anything else. People say it tastes like chicken. It's not. It's unique.
Yeah.
Literally, it's like getting 2 chicken wings. Do you want to tick chicken wings?
Yeah.
That's what it was like.
I'm not into tick chicken wings. I prefer a little...
Flats. The drumstick ones.
Oh, I like
the little flats.
The fatter ones.
Yeah, no, like, I like the little flat lads.
I'm telling you, lads, I try a lot of stuff. Like, meat-related stuff, no problem. I don't think it's an animal, I wouldn't eat. Mark, what we do, I guess, is we go back to the start. So tell us where you're from and what was life like growing up.
Okay. I'm from Cabinteely, originally. Grew up, went to St. Bridget's Boys School, National School in Cabinteely. And life was fine. Life was good. I was very lucky, you know. My parents were together for most of my childhood, well, until I was 12. Three siblings. I was definitely the sort of bold, naughty, you know, problematic child. I would like to say misunderstood, you know. I don't know why this has just come into my mind, but we had this lovely housekeeper who, because my mum worked, so she was out of the gaff all day. So we had a housekeeper called Mary, and she used to pick us up from school and bring us back to, you know, hers. And her husband had died a few months beforehand, and she was reeling from that loss. And whenever we go over to his house, to her house, there was always like his chair where he had sat, and obviously was now empty. And he used to always smoke a pipe in this chair. And I remember one time going, right, what I should do now is I should try and cheer her up. So she went up to the loo, and I went in and got like one of his pipes out, and then sat in the chair and was like, Mary, look, I'm Richard. Expecting it to go down really well, and suffice to say, it was a complete howler, almost as big as it was now. But no, life was good. I mean, I went, yeah, I just was I won't say I was a standard enough child, because I wasn't. I was always interested in tunes growing up, more so than sports, but I still played sports, like, you know yourself, whatever was going on around the estate. And then as life went on, I moved schools when I was around 8 or 9 into a rugby school. That was what it was. It was sort of what you'd expect, you know. And then as my teenage years went on, I probably became a little... That's when I was very difficult in school, and I didn't really like it, you know. I was very in and out of favour with friends and with teachers, and then wanting to leave school, wanting to drop out, but then be told, no, stay. I loved English. I loved doing English in school. Like, that was the only real reason I stayed, ultimately, is because I just loved doing everything about it, the poetry, the writing, all of it. And I had a brilliant teacher when I was in fifth year who, like, effectively just, like, said to me, you're not fucking dropping out. But aside from that, yeah, my school life was colourful, I'd say.
Mm. So, you said you liked English, so I'll imagine you liked the creative, expressive side. Do you think that's what that was?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I loved storytelling growing up. I loved writing stories. I mean, we were talking about Christy Moore earlier on, and I remember, like, just from a child, like, listening to my dad's music, you know, but the story, like, I loved, say, like, Bruce Springsteen, but I remember Christy Moore, because, you know, his lyrics you could understand as a very young child. Even if I didn't understand what they meant, I could follow the story along. And I loved storytelling. And there was something about English that just hooked me in. Like, from as long as I can remember, I just loved words and writing and the expression, I guess. And that was also then with music as well. Like, lyrics and music just meant everything to me. Like, I love listening to them.
Who were you listening to?
Spice Girls was where I started, genuinely. Yeah. You know, I'd like to say, I actually started on Radiohead, but no, it was probably just Spice Girls. I used to get tapes, and then I'd always record. I had Sanyo Ghetto Blaster, which they probably can't call them those anymore, can they? But I had a Sanyo speaker, and you used to have to listen to the radio and wait for whenever you think the song is going to come in, and then you know hit record. And Coolio Gangster, rest in peace, but Coolio Gangster's Paradise.
I'm sorry about coming across you. I'm glad another guest brought up Coolio, and we didn't have to do it.
Yeah, right, did you bring up Coolio?
He broke that mic, yeah.
Coolio broke this mic.
Oh, fuck, I think I remember seeing a picture of this.
Yeah.
He broke that microphone. Broke, and usually when we set up every podcast, that mic will go on like a random, like, fucking start spinning around or collapse.
Yeah, yeah.
And someone will have to come out and fix it. And we always say to the guests, sorry about this, Coolio broke the mic as a little icebreaker, and then tell the story about Coolio.
Ah, what a legend. Coolio was one of the good ones by all accounts.
Yeah, what a man.
So I'd record... tape. So the music then, it was pop music, whatever I was exposed to first. Like, my dad's stuff, dad was into everything from Supertramp to Bruce Springsteen, you know, like, lots of different stuff, which I guess, even if I didn't, like, I wasn't aware of what it was back then. I just liked listening to it. And then once I started being able to buy tapes and CDs, I'm assuming it was Eminem, but I remember buying a Wu-Tang. They started selling CDs in the local Texaco garage. I don't know why, but whenever CDs became like a thing, and it was all really obscure hip hop, totally bananas. But I remember buying a Wu-Tang CD and be like, holy shit, this is what I need to do with my life.
Yeah.
And that sort of was like the first like fantasy where I became convinced that like this was my destiny, was to become, you know, some form of gangster rapper. And I wish I was joking. I really wish I was joking. I'd be in the school bus on the way into like Donnybrook where I went to school, looking out the window going, none of these motherfuckers understand me. Just get me to the Bronx, then I'll be really understood. This little peach-bodied gobshite from Fox Rock with a fucking accent like mine. I wouldn't have lasted a wet week. But that was like the beginning of my obsession with hip-hop. And I mean obsession, because it was the words. And it was also the desire for something that wasn't what you have. And I mean, I'm embarrassed to admit that, of course, I had so much materially. I never wanted friending as a child. That's the sort of weird addictive mindset. I still needed more, and not more in a material sense, but more in a different. I needed my life to be different to the way that I knew it.
Need more fulfillment.
Yeah, Well, it always felt like there was something just around the corner that I needed to get to, you know? And hip-hop was like this, that I thought this was going to be the vehicle to get me there. And I became obsessed with hip-hop. Various rappers. Obviously, Eminem just left a huge influence on me as a child. Like, enormous. But I'd started rapping then. And I used to get into rap battles, going out to teenage discos. And then, like, I'd ditch school, and I'd go into... this is, by the way, let's be very clear, I'm not trying to paint a picture of myself that I'm like in any way street, okay? But there's a place in Store Street called Radio City.
Yeah.
And there used to be these like Rap Ireland.
Downstairs.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And there was these Rap Ireland parties. And Rap Ireland was a magazine by a guy, if I think I remember correctly, Kev Stores. So there was like a community of Irish heads who were really into hip hop and rap music. But it was quite... some of it at least was quite like just of the American, like, you know, you're from Raheny. Like, do you know what I mean? So like, it was this weird Irish crew who like, you know, we're very much Irish, but we got our aunties to buy us FUBU jeans when they went to New York, you know? Or like, I had a Sean John tracksuit. There was a shop on O'Connell Street, off O'Connell Street, I think on South Abbey Street, called like All City Sports. Not to be confused with All City Records and Temple Bar, but All City Sports or something, US Sports or something. And I remember persuading my mum for like my 12th birthday to bring me in and buy me a Sean John double tracksuit. So like, I was clearly delusional from day one, you know, at the age of 12. And I started just really loving music. And then, but I was in this like rugby playing school and also trying to fit in, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to pretend like I was staring out of windows all mopey and weepy for my teenage years. Like, and I talk about this in the book, you know, my response to being in the surroundings that I was in was like, I wanted to be popular. I wanted to be cool. You know, I wasn't good enough to be successful at rugby, but I was very much trying to be part of what was cool. You know, I didn't necessarily run the opposite direction. But I did feel very different. I remember like the rap music stuff just being a peculiar thing to many. I was 14, I think, is when people started drinking around 12, 13. But then it was probably 14 when I took my first drink. I talk about this in the book, and I don't want it to come across in any way self-pitying. And I actually had dinner with a very good friend of mine on the weekend, and he mentioned another part of the book where I talk about the first time I took MDMA, and he was like, was that me who gave it to you that night? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, man, like, do I owe you an apology? And I was like, unequivocally, no, because A, I asked for it, but B, if it wasn't from you, it would have been somebody else next week. Do you know what I mean? Nobody is responsible for my drinking other than me. But so when I was 14, I started drinking, but just to fit in, like just like everybody did. And I think therein lies the tragedy, where I felt really uncomfortable. I didn't like the fact that we were drinking. Like, I say this in the book, but I'm like, it's like we went to bed one night as kids in fucking wrestling pajamas, you know, and going to birthday parties and sleepovers where parents would literally tuck you in, you know, even if you they weren't your parents. And then, like, the next day it was like, how many people have you frigged this weekend? You're like, what? You know, and all of a sudden it was nagging cigarettes and all the rest. And I just sort of did it. And some alcoholics have this moment of like, bang, I had my first drink and the shoulders sagged and everything just got easier. It wasn't like that for me. Like, I was too anxious to allow myself enjoy the boozing because I just was so fucking aware of my body, of my place in the social group, of my uncertainty at, you know, at home and school. I was just fucking racked with this unease. So like, the drinking didn't hit me in a bang, you've arrived. Like, that didn't happen at the start, which, you know, in a way led to me for so long thinking that I'm not an alcoholic because it didn't happen at the start. Then time went on, and when I was, I think I was 15 or 16, I had my first panic attack. And in a weird way, like, I sort of, life, in the way I now, like, now remember life before and after COVID, in my teenage years, like, my first panic attack was like a defining moment. Because it just changed everything. It just changed everything in a horrible fucking way. Mm-hmm. Because experiencing a full-fledged panic attack with no idea of what it is, it's just the most terrifying feeling ever. And I was sitting in the back of science class and I'd fainted the weekend before. And I'd fainted about a year before because I was going through this growth spurt. But I'd clearly developed a fear then about fainting, that it was going to happen again, because of course it's like, it's very uncomfortable to faint. And I remember just sitting in science class, and I don't know what happened, but I just turned to my mate Dave and I was like, call an ambulance, I'm going to die. And like, literally like this, my body started fucking, I was like, I'm going to die. And he was like, what's wrong? I was like, I don't know. But like, that in an instant, I felt like I'm going to have a heart attack, but I'm also losing my mind. But I don't know how to communicate this to the person beside me or to my teacher. Because then she was looking at me going, what is wrong with you? And I was like, I'm going to die. And then she was like, okay, get Mark out of here. And they brought me out down to the, you know, down to the principal's office. And the principal comes out and they're trying to help you, but they don't really know what's going on. And the panic would sort of come in waves where it would happen like that, where I'd be like screaming and like really frenetic and like the fight or flight, I guess, would kick in. And I'd be like, okay, I need to get out of here. Call an ambulance. I'm going to die. And then it would stop for a second, but I'd be like really worried because anticipating the next wave of panic. And also, sorry, at this point, this is the first time I've ever had a panic attack. And I'd never heard the term panic attack before in my life. So that happened. And like, again, I don't want to say that that contributed to my later drinking. Of course it did, but everything contributed to my drinking, you know, and that's not to say, oh, if I had only gotten treatment for my panic attacks, I did. Like, my mum drove me around to fucking everybody that we could think of in terms of specialists and doctors. Not one person said to me, you've got anxiety or panic disorders. And again, I'm not saying that to blame the doctors. That's just, it wasn't discussed back then. It wasn't a thing. People were like, you probably have diabetes. Mm. Or, you know, the fainting thing. They sent me for EKGs or, you know, the heart, all the various heart things. They wanted to do these tests on my heart to see if, you know, that was blood tests, all the rest. But nobody said, like, Jesus, like, you know, maybe a panic attack's a thing.
It's in your head.
It's in my head.
The bleeding, a response from your body. Yeah.
That's the thing. And I then, as a result of that, I then became like hyper health conscious, where I'd be going into my mum's bedroom at like 3 o'clock in the morning going, I've got a brain tumor, I'm going to die. And she'd be going, you're not, like, it's okay, everything's fine. And there was a couple of, like, I'd say there's about a year there where, like, again, like, my mum was providing me that, you know, getting me the help that we thought I needed. But I guess because it was undiagnosed, I just felt like I was this fucking alien. Do you know what I mean? And like all those teenage feelings of isolation that, by the way, every teenager has. I'm not unique in experiencing any of this. But I guess that really amplified it and made me go, like, I am not able to go out in the way that Terry or Calvin can go out. Like, they're just relaxed. They can go out and meet the guys and go to the park and drink whatever and be fine. And I just bottled that up. I didn't talk about it to anyone. I didn't say, oh, by the way, I'm really suffering here. I just, like, tried to control it, which is, you know, ultimately my biggest downfall is trying to control the outcome of situations and trying to control how life is. Mm. So I was getting more and more into music at the time. I really wanted to drop out. I was joining bands, writing songs all the time. And I was just like, I started getting like classic teenage cringe, but I was like, I don't need to be around these people who just want to do a normal life and a normal job and a normal, I just want to make music and be around creative people. I don't want to be around like these rugby player jocks. Like I'm fucking, you know, a South Dublin gangster rapper, don't you know? And I was just like, I need to get out of here. And the drinking wasn't that bad. Like I definitely got a taste for it in sixth year more and was going out lots more. Like just simple things. Like guys would usually go out once a week. But I'd have friends to go out with on the Friday night, but then I'd also go out with the older lads on the Saturday night. You know, so there's just all these little signs, maybe. And then the summer we finished, I didn't want to do the leaving, but my mum, like, again, was like, please, just do the leaving, get the sheet of paper. You can do whatever the fuck you want with your life afterwards. I just want you to get yourself a leaving cert. And, like, I remember the week I was doing the leaving, my brother was, like, he was a couple of years ahead. He was out in some rugby tournament and there's all of his mates were at the pub and I went down and I was like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. My mum rang me, was like, just please come home. You've got the leaving cert in like 2 days. Like, you need to be home. And I was like, this is where I'm meant to be. And it's so embarrassing thinking about that now. But again, I believed it. Like, yeah. I just felt so at home in pubs. I realised now, because I didn't have any anxiety, I was fucking drinking and I just felt I could breathe. And that feeling has been like, was with me then forever, that after two drinks, life was okay.
Mm.
Those issues that I was worried about, that racing mind, it just fucking brought it down. But of course, then I never stopped at two drinks. So then I moved to Brighton.
Yeah.
After about 4 months, the panic attacks had gotten worse and like it was really bad. And I was just drinking every day. So I went to the NHS, didn't tell anyone back at home, but went to the doctor and was like, look, I think I'm an alcoholic. He did the classic, how much are you drinking? And of course you lie. You know, like, oh, well, how much is a unit? And well, if that's twice a day, then blah, blah, blah. The units are small these days. They're smaller than they used to be and blah, blah, blah. And I told him whatever. And he was like, right, well, like, look, I don't think you're an alcoholic yet, but you're definitely displaying like some concerning, you know, panic attacks, like this anxiety, you know, all of these thoughts, like we need to address this. But all I heard was, you are not an alcoholic yet.
Mm.
Bang, that's all I needed. Off I went.
So he fed into your denial.
He fed into my denial.
Yeah. Mm.
And again, it doesn't come down to like, oh, you needed to be drinking a litre of vodka a day, because I wasn't at that stage. You know what I mean? I wasn't at any stage of my drinking a litre of vodka a day. But I knew my drinking was different. And I knew, like, you know, you could see it in my eyes, like the way that I would drink. It was like, I'm drinking for different reasons.
Yeah.
And it was the frequency. I was drinking fucking every day. So then, yeah, it was back to Dublin. I was working in an office, like doing shredding and stuff, which was just, I just fucking hated it. I remember on like the first day, I didn't realize that like office language has to be a thing. Like you have to be, you know, you have to speak like in a certain way. And I was chatting in the break room and there was like three, you know, people having their sandwiches and reading the newspapers. And someone's like, oh, do you see this? It says that apparently dolphins are the only other animals aside from human beings to enjoy sex recreationally. And they were like, oh, that's mad. And I was like, yeah, no, that's definitely true. And she was like, how do you know? And I was like, well, anytime I've been with fungi, he seemed to have a good night. And she complained about me instantly.
Yeah.
Complete rat. Apparently inappropriate. But I got that job. And then I got a call from a guy called Anthony Remedy, who owned Andrews Lane Theatre. And he was like, oh, I'd like you to set up a club night here. We do this, like, if you want to do a club night. And I was like, okay. Because I guess I was like going out loads, you know, socializing. I was hanging out in maybe the right places is probably the wrong term to use. But you know what I mean? And I said, yeah, great. I'd like to do a hip hop night. And he was like, no chance. Hip hop at the time in Dublin was a problem. Like you did a club night. It was like in London, they banned basically doing like hip hop music and rap music nights for a long time because of just serious problems. I think in Croydon, there was like a very bad riot back in the late 90s or the early 2000s. But anyway, it was basically hip hop and rap music was a no-go, like, you know? And I said, I promise you, I was like, this is what everyone's listening to at home on their iStations at their pre-drinks before they go out. Like, this is the shit that they listen to. They're not listening to Chart. And he was like, right, what would we call it? And I was like, Brooklyn Zoo, after Elderly Bastard, you know, from Wu-Tang. So, yeah, put together like a little branding thing, announced Brooklyn Zoo. And then just like, I was doing a music production course at the time, I just remembered, in sound engineering school in Temple Bar during the day. And then started this club night and it just fucking like, it just absolutely exploded. like 3,000 people. Oh, no, sorry, 3,000 people. What the hell am I talking about? 495 or something. 500 people every weekend at Andrews Lane Theatre. But like queues around, like all the way up to South William Street, and got shut down by the guards a couple of times. But it just absolutely flew. And like that was just fuel to the fire. I could drink then. I was making cash, was making money, getting paid in cash. I was 21, didn't have a Swiss about fucking tax or anything like that. And I was just living the life like this was, and also the hip hop and, you know, all the ego and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I am living the dream now. So that's when I started drinking, just like, and partying, and it just kept going.
But I had drugs in the equation at that time.
Drugs weren't. One of the things that I always held on to, until of course I didn't, was that I didn't do drugs.
Yeah.
Because that made me better than people who did drugs. Mm. Again, one of the other rules that I had, if I don't do drugs, if I'm just drinking, I'm not as bad.
Yeah.
Because I wanted always to go under the radar with my drinking. So don't be the person that's legless that gets carried out. Don't be the person doing drugs, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I also thought, like, I could go to after sessions and stay up till 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 a.m. just drinking. And I was like, look at how great I am. That shows that I'm, like, made of strong stuff, I guess, even though... It's like, mate, it shows you're drinking a fucking enormous amount. So no, drugs were around, but they weren't around in the way that they were, say, 4 or 5 years later. Like Dublin at that time. So we did a year or two at Andrews Lane. Then we moved to Lafayette on Dallaire Street. And that was just, that was bigger again. And it just like really, really flew. But no, I don't, like, I remember vaguely cocaine becoming part of what people did after nights out.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, on the night out. And then I started making, I was still trying to do music, and that's sort of roughly then when I met Mark Feely from Westlife. And then I started like writing songs with him, and then the idea was, right, like, you, like, I wanted to give this a go. I moved back to London, and then the club night stuff started drying up as a result. I was out over in London, I was living in East London with mates from like Leeds, like just sound lads, but I lived in this little granny flat at the back of the garden. And I set up like speakers and KRKs, and like I had my music production stuff there as well. In hindsight, that's probably the happiest I've ever been, because like I was around guys who were like really like-minded. We all loved the same tunes, and like, but just good friends. And we were going out to the same sort of shows, and I just fucking kept drinking. I just didn't stop drinking. That was the problem. Like I'd go out, like, again, when everybody would be having the off night, I just slip away to myself and, you know, tip away in my bedroom by myself, which is just like the fatal flaw. And then I got into a relationship straight away after about 8 weeks. When I got into this relationship, like, the wheels were coming off, and I was becoming that guy then who was getting messy on nights out, and I was becoming argumentative. And all of a sudden, my general demeanor, like, was, you know, everyone has a problem with me. Everywhere I go, I'm already defensive, already, you know, when you see those guys in pubs and they're waiting for somebody to say something to them. That was like me. Now, I wasn't violent ever, but in pubs or anything like that. And again, that was another thing that I was like, see, I'm not a bad drunk. Because if I was a bad drunk, I'd be throwing digs. Whereas actually, you can be about, your tongue's just as fucking lethal. You know what I mean? Mm. And the wheels started coming off where I was just sloppy. And I was around 26, 25. And then I started, 26, I think. And then I started doing cocaine then. And I'm reluctant, to be brutally honest with you, I'm reluctant to say too much, only because, like, I've said what I said in the book about cocaine, but there are a couple of online dirty rags that any time I've mentioned cocaine, they put it in a fucking headline. And it just infuriates me. So I'm like tentative to say anything that's different.
Yeah, I find that mad, you know, considering how rampant cocaine is.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, if it came out that anybody tomorrow in the mainstream in Ireland was doing cocaine, I wouldn't be like, fuck, that's shocking. I'd be like, yeah, well, like, the statistics add up that there's a good chance this person does take cocaine.
I know people who sniff most days of the week, and they can go to work early morning, 6 o'clock till probably 1 or 2 o'clock, go to the pub, have that pints, sniff that coke, and do that 5 days a week, and then whatever they do on the weekends. We know people who do that Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
Every single fucking week. Never miss a day in work. How are you able to do that?
You see, this is the thing. And it is interesting because, like, everybody has their own theories about addiction and about, you know, the cause. Like, for instance, the one that I get a lot is ADHD. And I'm in the process of trying to get a diagnosis because, especially since I stopped drinking and stuff, it's one thing. But especially once I stopped smoking, I'm fucking gone. Like, I've been told since I was a kid I had ADHD, but I never did anything first. And now I just want to be a bit careful because, like, taking a stimulant, you know, I'm just a little bit, and it's not to dismiss the treatment. It's, you know, I know it helps people enormously, but I'm just a little bit careful about taking something that could be a stimulant, you know. Anyway, I'm looking into it. But it's like, is that the cause, and does the addiction come from that? Or does the addiction, is it a disease of the spirit? Do you know what I mean? Wherein you're just born that way. Like, was it always going to happen?
Mm.
Regardless. Yeah. And or does it even matter, like?
Yeah. It's something to really think about, though, isn't it? Because I think about that all the time, like, with that kind of thing, you kind of think, was it just destined to go that route?
Like, if we've lived completely different lives.
Yeah.
But we can identify wholeheartedly on those feelings of whatever, the needing that more, the unfulfillment, the around the corner, the just out of arm's reach.
Mm.
And if, like, especially if people have had those feelings from day one, it's just...
Yeah.
That's what I do say about, like, we've had guests on who had these seriously traumatic childhoods and end up in addiction. You can be like, well, like, get it.
You've seen
what happened when you were a kid. It was a model that you were going to go that way. And then we've had people on who were just like, I lived a normal life. I was happy as a teenager. Then I just got a bit insecure.
Yeah.
And I ended up in addiction. And you're like, they're the ones that fascinate me more because you're like, you can't pinpoint it. You're like, that just happened.
Yeah, that's exactly it. No, it's funny because when you hear... It's almost embarrassing to admit, like, when I hear people with stories with legitimate, serious external trauma, and they were subjected to some of the most brutal horrors imaginable. And I'm like, Jesus, like, what the fuck is my excuse for feeling like this?
Mm.
So that relationship when I was living in London fell apart. And realistically, it was largely due to my, just drinking. So I came back to Dublin. Desperately trying to get a different job back in London. Then I got a job in the BBC. And, I sort of, as a sideline to all of this, I'd started going viral on Facebook with comedy videos when I was like 22. I used to do these monologues of me talking to the camera. I did this first one where it was just like deadpan, basically saying that my girlfriend was taken to hospital because she was hungover and apparently she couldn't even. And like the doctor had to like give her an emergency Domino's meal deal and spoon her and all the rest. And it just like blew up. And I started then doing these monologues to camera and pieces to camera. And I'd sort of wanted to become a comedian, but I didn't really know how to become a comedian without doing stand-up. And I didn't want to do stand-up. So when I came back to Dublin and after the music had dried up, like I was really determined to do something in comedy. And I'd set up some like Twitter accounts like that were viral and South Dublin Girl Twitter and different things. But I'd never figured out a way of like monetizing this. Because when I was doing Facebook videos, I was getting like millions of views, but there was no money like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You didn't get any return on it other than like people recognizing you. That was it. Bastards.
Get backdated.
The retrospective pay. And then I got a job in BBC Comedy. And it was to work in, you know, doing social media campaigns for like some of the biggest comedies. And I was like, this is the fucking dream job. I'm in the door. Finally, after like my entire life of doing things differently and doing things the Mark Megan way and always been weird and left of center, I've got like a real job. Like I never went to uni. And I was like, this is it. And this will sort out my drinking. Because again, I thought that the right job would sort it out. The right girlfriend would sort it out. The right amount of money. There would always be something that would sort it out.
Yeah.
And... within 2 weeks of the BBC, I wasn't getting paid enough. The work wasn't challenging enough. All the usual shit, but I didn't even realise. Like, and it's exhausting to repeat it out now because I know I'm like...
Well, I struggle sometimes as well when I'm talking about my life in the past because you're talking about it in complete retrospect. Like, you know now the pinpoints of certain moments of what was going on. But in them moments, you don't know what's going on.
No, it's exhausting. You're just and it's the running. Like, it's exhausting repeating it. But I'm also so embarrassed and I'm so ashamed because it's so, when you read it out like the way I'm reading it out now, chronologically, I'm like, oh man, like you're fucking Egypt. You just needed to be, like, you needed a good slap and to be told, cop on. So it was really exhausting, but things went okay. And, you know, I was a great man for bringing things right to the edge of like where things could get really, really bad. And then I'd step back in from the ledge. Like my mental health was just appalled. Like it would just fallen off a cliff. And you know, I mentioned this in the book, but like there were times when like I considered the worst, and there were times when I fell into that trap of like not really wanting to live, and sort of like the dog who catches the fucking mailman or like the rubbish truck or whatever. It's like I'd gotten what I wanted, or what I thought I wanted. This job at the BBC, because I didn't need to be embarrassed anymore calling back home. Because for years I'd be so embarrassed. Oh, you still at the music, are you? You're still trying to do this. Whereas now I'm like, oh, I work in the BBC. Like it's a reputable organisation. Mm. Like I'm a legitimate person. And I'd gotten that. And that people, you know, that them that I'd spent my whole life trying to impress, nobody gave a shit. Why would they like? Oh, you work in the BBC, cool, nice one. When's your show coming out? Shut up, I sent a few tweets yesterday. Do you know?
Yeah.
Like it's... And I just kept going then. And it was just, look, on and off. And then, like, the occasional mental health day, the occasional sickness, the occasional this. And I came back to Dublin for a wedding, made a holy show of myself the night before. The guards called the house. Then I'd met a friend of mine and he was like, you need to do something comedy-wise, like, beyond working the BBC. And I was like, yeah, I don't know what to do. And he was like, you need to do a podcast. I was like, I don't know about that. I can't even afford the equipment. I got back to London after that weekend of wedding, supposed to be sober. And he had the recording equipment waiting for me with just like a letter going, press record. And a good friend of mine, Neil Mulhern. And that following week, I was on the straight and narrow and I thought I was done drinking. I started the Sunday Roast podcast. And that was like the first moment of my adult life, or probably my life, where I actually properly expressed myself. In a comedy way, you know, in a different way to the videos where I was doing a character. This is just like free-flowing self-expression. And I was also sober, albeit for 7 days. And I was like, this is it. And I released the podcast. I think the first episode was me roasting Halloween or something. And I think my opening line is me talking about, oh no, it couldn't have been the first episode then. Anyway, I speak a lot about alcohol in the early days of the podcast, but it was called The Sunday Roast. And it's just like, I released it and it just exploded. And I was like, holy fuck, this is like, amazing. Like, you know, you guys know the feeling. You're shouting into the abyss, but there's like people talking back for once, you know. There people send you messages going, I'm in Australia and I listen to your podcast in the morning whenever I do this. You're like, what? Like, it just blows your mind.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like, you feel a sense of connection. Like, you feel this insane purpose and belonging. And I was like, that's great. I'm never going to drink again, you know. So a week later, I started drinking again because I'm an alcoholic. Because that's just what I do. Like, I got everything I wanted. I was getting all these messages saying, you're brilliant, you're great, you're funny, you're whatever. The podcast was like the top of the charts and all the rest. Great. That's a really good excuse to start drinking, isn't it? Like, because if I was in trouble, if my life was so bad, I wouldn't be able to be doing a great podcast. You know, again, that fucking deception creeps in. I can control it this time because now I've gotten what I wanted. I was only drinking before in desperation to try and chase the dream. But now I've got the dream.
Yeah.
I'm making money from either Patreon, like making money. I got to the point where I was like making more from my salary, making more from the Patreon than I was my monthly salary from the BBC. So I was like, this is fucking great.
Mm.
I'm going to be off to the races here. And I started drinking again. And within like a month, a few months, I started, oh yeah, I missed this week due to whatever reason. Play the mental health card. And like in theory, yeah, it was mental health, but it was brought on by drinking drugs.
Yeah, self-inflicted.
Self-inflicted, exactly.
Yeah.
And that went on for another 18 months. I came back to Dublin and with COVID. And again, I thought COVID would be the reason. That's perfect. Everything will stop. Because for my whole life, I felt like everything was going too fast. And it's just like, everything just needs to slow down. Can we just get a handle of it? Let's just get a sense of what's going on here so we can figure out how best to proceed. And I thought, COVID, unbelievable. This will sort me right out. I drank. Sort of just like, it's like what I do. You know what I mean? And I stopped doing the podcast. I did a couple. I remember one time sending my friend, Neil, a podcast. I had woken up and I couldn't think straight, so just started drinking again. And I recorded it on a Sunday. And I was like, this is the greatest podcast I've ever recorded. It's only 9 minutes long and it doesn't need to be any longer because it's so good. That's how just like, just fucking unhinged. I sent it to my mate and he was like, you're going to have to stop here. Like, you're going to have to stop drinking. He was like, you've got like this success and like podcasting and comedy and what you've apparently always wanted, or you've got the drinking and the partying, like, but you can only choose one, like, you know. And I remember he suggested that I go to treatment. And I remember, bang, fuck you. Like, I cut him, like, just no interest. I had no interest in somebody seeing me for what I was.
Yeah.
Because that's a really, like, violating feeling when you think you're doing a great job of spoofing people, you know? And you think you're doing a good job of, like, spinning these plates. Oh, yeah, everything's fine, everything's fine, everything's fine. And he's like, you know it's not. And you know I see that it's not fine. And the idea of treatment for me was like fucking gutter. That was the end of the line. That was like, no fucking way am I that bad. Because again, for me, it was a competition. I was losing. Like this battle thing. It was like, but that would be such a defeat. Then at the time, I didn't realize that defeat would be what sets you free. Mm. But at the time, I was so pig-headed and so ignorant and so determined to win and beat this thing and be in control that like I just couldn't tolerate or buy the idea of accepting that I was losing control entirely. And then that went on and off and on and off. And I started trying to get sober myself. Couldn't get sober myself. I got back in the drink, got into a new relationship. I was 7 weeks sober when I met her. After 3 weeks, then I was drinking again. And, you know, as with everything in life, it started off beginning just like the BBC, just like everything else. Everything would start off great, but it would be the gradual unraveling. It's like you're in so much pain, but all of this is only prolonging it. And you're also hurting others. You're letting people down. You're disappointing people, you know, and you're interfering with other people's lives and taking their time only to fucking throw it all in their faces by drinking again when you say you wouldn't. So that went on. And then I started looking for addiction counsellors. But I went to an addiction counsellor and I came out of there and I drank that night because I was like, I'm not an alcoholic, because I told her the right things. Oh, I'm just a comedian with a busy mind, blah, blah, fucking blah, just nonsense. Garbage, you know?
All them little spells of sobriety. Did you ever once actually think you were going to stay sober?
Yeah, honestly, I did, because it was manic. There was times in those, like there was in those early days before like the very last stage, which I'll get to now, but it was this like euphoric sobriety. I'm going to run a 5K every morning. Look at me posting a Fred Again tune at 5 a.m. to the sunrise. Let's go. I'm fucking smashing. I could record 3 podcasts in a day. Just completely insane ego. Telling everybody I go, I don't drink, by the way. I don't drink. A week off the sauce, you know? But then I drink and then it would be worse. And every, as I said, like every time I drank, then I'd be like trying to condense all of the drinking that I didn't do into one night. But then after the addiction counselor, then there's like relationship troubles and like just everything was falling apart. And I knew that it was falling apart. I then had a really bad mental health scare after like an all night session. And I presented at like a GP and my GP was like, you know, explain the lay of the land. And we discussed lots of different options about how to proceed. And, you know, I begged and pleaded about not going into treatment. And then I lasted 6 weeks of sobriety. But that was like white knuckle, like living life like I was wearing a straitjacket, you know? Like that's when I couldn't fathom really why I'd want to live. Because I knew I couldn't drink again. There was like, it was like a prison sentence. I knew like you're not able to drink again now. And you've done the cat's out of the bag. Like you've gone to the GP. That's on your record now, what you said to him in desperation. But he has that, like, and you can't call him up 5 days later like you could your mates or an ex-girlfriend and go, oh, no, things are different now. You know, I've actually dealt with some personal stuff and I'm actually able to go for a few drinks tonight. You know, that's just there, written down. And so sobriety then was, like, really, really isolating. And I didn't tell anybody either. The only person I knew was, like, two of my mates and my ex. Because, like, again, deep down, there was probably that, like, don't tell everybody. Hold on to this, it's yours to control. And that was like unbearable. Life was unbearable for those 6 weeks. And it was at the tail end of COVID. So, I mean, it was very easy to go 6 weeks without seeing people. I just didn't see people. I didn't do anything. And then I went to a wedding and I drank because I just couldn't. I just arrived. I had no intention of drinking, of course. I'd absolutely no plans or desire to drink. But I walked in and I just realized I am totally incapable of life. So I drank and it was awful. And then finally after the first night I drank, I came clean to the ex and she was like, you know, just get yourself home. Phone off again. We go at it again because why not? I've already fucked it. May as well, you know, dig deep here. And I went at it again. And then, 6 or 7 that morning, went to bed, stayed awake for however long, just, you know, the worst feeling, like lying in bed and feeling yourself become sober but you're not really sober, but you're just the all the positive effects of the booze and everything else is wearing off. And I was just done. And I sat up and I just cried my eyes out like a fucking baby. And I was just completely done. My sister was like, what's going on? I tried, like, you know, blamed on the relationship woes or various other things going on in my life. But I knew then, this is it. Like, Mark, this whole charade of an existence that you've been doing for the last 15 years, it's time for it to end. And it's, when I say end, but it is, like, I'm done now. It's over. Like, the jig is up with myself, if that makes sense. I was, just couldn't continue fighting that fight myself.
That was your turn to tell then?
Yeah. And that was the 25th of October, 21. That was the 24th, actually. But I don't count the 24th because I was up till 7 a.m. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And yeah, that was my, you know, the following day, 25th is my day one. And yeah, I haven't had a drink or drug since, thankfully.
Fair play to you. Congratulations on that one. But it's not fucking easy.
It was, everything changed then because I asked for help. You know, it's not like, it's nothing to do with, as ridiculous as it sounds, it's nothing to do with me other than just continuously asking for help, which is fucking every day. You know, and like saying yes to letting people in, I think, is an enormous part of it. Because for me, so much of the drinking stems from like, so much of it stems from like a disconnection with myself.
Mm.
And, you know, the voice in my head, which sounds frighteningly just like mine, that says you're a piece of shit or go drinking or, you know, life's not worth it without drinking. You need to drink, you need to live. Like, it's about not listening to that voice and using my own voice to say, like, I'm struggling. And yeah, I mean, like, I could be here all day talking about what's on the other side, but as somebody said to me very recently, he's like 38 years sober, and he was like, Mark, when I started drinking I was 15, and when I stopped drinking I was 15, you know, emotionally.
Yeah,
because like once I put the drink down,
you start living from that point again.
Yeah, because it's like, I thought once I put the drink down, great stuff, I'll be headlining the Apollo. You know, I'll be off fucking making movies. I'll be skinny. I'll be like ripped to shreds. I'll be running marathons. I'll be doing all this stuff. I didn't realize, like, you need to learn how to live. And the amount of stuff that I just, like, I'm learning how to drive now. You know, I can drive now, which is so ridiculous. And I know it's embarrassing to be like, I'm 33 and I'm learning how to drive. But that's just like a simple, beautiful aspect of recovery. It's like being able to go and learn how to fucking drive. Been able to pay for the dentist to do things that are like, I got 2 colonoscopies last year. We discussed, you know, being able to actually look after yourself and take care of yourself and go, something's wrong, I'll get it looked at. You know, I'll go to the doctor, I'll ask for help, I'll learn how to fucking drive. It's a life beyond my wildest dreams, and it's all the normal stuff that
they sound so simple.
Yeah.
But I get it so much, like, for me, it's holidays.
I remember seeing,
I can go on a fucking holiday, Mark. Like, I used, like, I'd been away like 3 or 4 times in my life, and by the time me mid-20s.
Mm.
And 2 of them holidays, one, I went to Benidorm, got lost for 3 days. Yeah. Well, for 2 days, I was missing in the desert on my own.
Mm.
Like, no joke. Mm. And we've told the story in a very comedic way. But chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, chaos. So it's not really a holiday, is it? You're on your own in the desert for 2 days out of 3 nights out there. And another holiday that I was on in my early 20s would have been to Portugal, where we went away for 3 nights and I didn't leave the hotel room once.
Yeah.
I went away to sit in a hotel room for 3 nights to get the flight back home depressed.
That's the thing.
Like, so now, like, I'm starting to do this thing where I'm like going on holidays and actually going on a fucking holiday.
Man, I remember seeing your stories in Thailand recently, and I remember just like feeling that joy emanating from you, because I had a moment like this last year. Myself and Darren went on a cruise. And I would have been the person to be like, a fucking cruise, like, that's so, I'm not like American in my 60s, you know, blah, blah, blah. It was the greatest holiday I've ever been on in my life. And it was the first time in my recovery, I think, where I actually didn't feel like an alcoholic properly, because every day we were doing something different, constant like stimulation, new experiences, new people, new food, new life, you know. Oh, it was just like, I remember at one point we were in a taxi going down, like hurtling through the Turkish mountains to try and find Ephesus or Ephesus or however you pronounce it. And the Greek experts, the Turkish experts, I was about to say. But I remember just looking at her and going, this is the business. Like, this is living now.
Yeah.
And it's so ridiculous. But I'm like, I'm in here and the Turkish taxi driver is trying to tell me he knows Paddy the Turk, this hairdresser in Dunleary. He knows like a couple of Turkish guys, you know, that doing making a connection with the Turkish guy. And we're explaining like he's got broken English. I've no Turkish, but the Google translates out. We're just having a laugh and I'm looking around and going, this is fucking just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like this is like it, as you say, it's not the big stuff like doing podcasts or even, by the way, releasing the book. Like,
yeah.
The book's a nice part of my journey, but like it's that stuff doesn't, in the grand scheme of things, that doesn't make the difference. The difference is being in the airport, coming home from a holiday and being like, I'm actually not dreading. Yeah. Because going home from a holiday used to be the end of the road for me because I would always have spent all of my money, probably borrowed. And then like 3 weeks before I went on holidays, I would have been in like holiday mode. Do you know what I mean? So by the time I even went on holidays, I would have been burnt out.
Yeah.
Like Christmas, I could never enjoy because I'd start drinking just after Halloween. Like I'd be gone. You know, so by the time the actual big event came, it was too late.
Mm.
Whereas now coming home from a holiday, you know, feeling like mildly fresh, just going, yeah, things are fine. I've got clean clothes.
Mm.
Coming home to an airport wearing clean underwear.
It sounds dramatic, doesn't it?
It sounds really, and people go like, oh, just shut up. Like, yeah. But that's the truth of it.
It is the truth. Look, I had a phone call with a friend of mine. Now he's locked up at the moment, but he's suffering with addiction as well himself. Yeah. And he's like, he kind of made me go, oh, fuck, actually, I'm doing something hell. Like, I told him I'm going to Thailand. And he was like, what the fuck, you're going to Thailand? Like, Imagine saying this a few years ago, that you'll be going to the toilet. Yeah. You should be in a cell next to me saying.
Yeah.
And then the conversation went on. He was like, I'm hoping when I get out of here, like, I can probably get to Spain for a week with the kids, but I don't even know if that's possible. It just puts it into perspective that it sounds like it's just a holiday, and it probably is just a holiday to most people.
Mm.
When circumstances come into play, it's so much more.
It's a completely different thing. Like, it's also like the gratitude element. Mm. You know, when people say that to me, they're like, Mark, a grateful drunk's a sober drunk. When I go to bed and I realise, like, just like that moment you talk about being the friend to your mate, being in the phone to your friend, being so aware in that instant how fucking lucky you are for what sobriety is giving you. Do you know what I mean? When you have those hyper realisations, I get them like very often and I'm like, I could punch myself for the day. So I wake up and I'm like, oh, I haven't gotten enough offers on X today, or I haven't got enough emails, or I haven't gotten blah, blah, blah. I'm going, are you aware of your life now? Like, and versus where it was, like, you know, and it's all in the book, like, but even just, I used to have to like hide wine bottles in gym bags and wrap them in beach towels and bring them out of my fucking flat so the girls wouldn't hear me. Be like, because they might think I'm an alcoholic then. Do you know what I mean? Like the shame of that, then going down to the bottle bank beside Sea Point, going, hopefully nobody sees me. And it's like that, even, it's just a micro thing. But to be able to just walk around today and also not have the fear of bumping into people.
Mm.
When I met you guys today, I'm able to go, good to meet you, like.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I'm able to go look you in the eye and say, I'm a bit nervous, but it'll be fine. You know, I'm not hiding all the time.
Mm.
You've removed the chaos and you're living in the moment. That is. And I don't think enough people actually realise that. Not even people that are external to that, but we know plenty of people, Terry, that are in that at the moment and they don't realise how chaotic their life is. Mm. And we could see it from the outside, but they're just not there yet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They haven't had that clarity yet. And hopefully it comes soon because they need it. But this is what you're talking about now. These are the moments you're living life, you're feeling natural highs, you're seeing stuff and you're like, that's fucking class.
Yeah.
You'd need a substance to make a class.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just being there made a class. So when did you write the book, Mark?
Wrote the book last year, and I remember I was around, I think I'd hit like 18 months sober, and the novelty of being sober had worn off, and it was only beginning to dawn on me like life is very different now. Like it's there's a lot to think about in terms of I thought that I would have been out the gap once I'd stopped drinking, and you know, oh yeah, things will just, like, life will just take off and you never have to look back. And actually, you don't even need to think about your drinking. But then after the 18 months, I realised, okay, there was a reason why I drank. There were lots of reasons why I drank, you know. So I felt like quite stifled in my life, where I was putting shit out on Instagram, acting the bollocks, like not really knowing who I was, because I'm like, well, I can't talk about doing this because I don't do that anymore. I don't know what people do in those situations anymore. And I just felt like I felt really out of sorts with everything. And I wasn't writing. You know, I wasn't writing music at all, but I also wasn't writing any sort of comedy. I was working on a sketch show with somebody, but it wasn't like being developed, blah, blah, blah. And I remember just like one night going to Darren, my fiance, being like, I'm fucking like, I don't know if I need to move away. I don't know if I need to get out of Ireland, but something's going to have to give, because this, like that age old feeling, like this life at the moment isn't doing it for me. And she was like, what's wrong? Like, and we just had a really good conversation about like, I was like, there's just so much in me that I need to fucking figure out about my years of drinking. That I'm still, by the way, only at the precipice of, you know, understanding more of. And she was like, just write it down. Like, write the book. Write your story. And I was like, you know, no way. Nobody would care. My experiences aren't like, I didn't end up on the streets. You know, I came from a nice family. You know what I mean? Nobody gives a shit. And she was like, I thought you said that, you know lots of alcoholics from every different, and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, yeah, okay. And I just started writing it. And writing about the teenage stuff was like the most revealing to me, because initially I spoke to the publishers, Teresa Daly, an amazing publisher in Gale. And she was like, yeah, you know, we were working on how the book would look like, because I had said, under no circumstances is the book the answer. It's not a book about how to stop drinking, mm-hmm. by any means, or how to get sober and all the rest. And I was like sort of slagging self-help books when we were chatting, because I was like, you know, I used to do this whole thing about you can never write two self-help books because then you're a spoofer, because it means your first one doesn't, if your first one had all the answers, there shouldn't need to be a part two.
Yeah.
You know? That should be enough. But so she was, so I was writing the book and I was like, okay, so I'll just start writing about drinking. She was like, no, let's go back to you as a child. And I was like, oh, I don't like the idea of that. She was like, well, you have to, like, you're going to have to give people, you know, a bit of context. And I did. And since I've written the book, I get messages every day from alcoholics, but also non-alcoholics, just normal people being like, holy shit. Like, I've never, like, that experience as a child, as a teenager, you know, that's like exactly the way mine was, which is just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And it was challenging to write about teenage feelings and like body issues and self, you know, and panic attacks and all these things, but it's the only way, really, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I need to clear my throat. I'm not crying.
I thought you're getting a bit emotional there. Yeah. No, you're very kind of, for someone who's very expressive, you've a great vocabulary, by the way.
Thank you.
You're very reserved as well, though. And for your sobriety, it's still kind of, as you said, it's still in its infancy.
Mm.
To write a book then, that must have been very difficult.
It helped my sobriety, I think, because it helped me make sense of it. And it helped me also on the doubting days, you know, because I do get them. I do get the, were you that bad?
Mm.
Or not even were you that bad? Maybe I was bad, but could I have taken it further? Could I have gotten another couple of years out of it? Or could I have just stepped back from the ledge a little bit longer and then given another go? You know, on those sort of days, I then look at the book and I read about and I remind myself about how I felt for the guts of a decade. And I realise, Mark, like, your drinking days are done, like, you know? I think it was a really vital tool, like, being able to chart those feet, especially the latter, excuse me, the latter three chapters of the book where I talk about, you know, what happens once you put the drink down. I was writing that, excuse me, again, I'm not tearing up. There's something legitimately in my throat. I was writing those chapters as I was living them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it was really cathartic and it was really like, yes, shit, sobriety is heavy. Like, sobriety isn't this walk in the park, because you are always awake. You are always in the room. You know what I mean? And I think it was like the writing was a sort of a companion almost, you know, as I tried to figure out what it's like to be sober and to be sober, yeah, you know, in early sobriety.
Mm-hmm. That's why I don't think enough people actually realise that you're in every moment. Yeah. You're there for everything when you're sober. There's no blackout. You're not piecing that together. You're there. You're awake for all of it, as you said. You don't miss anything. Nothing is cloudy. Nothing is foggy. It's hard to remember.
Well, especially in early sobriety as well. I think people forget that. Like, in early sobriety, you mentioned like 18 months in.
Mm.
That, like, my momentum was like 6 months.
Mm-mm.
Where you're like, you want to tell the world you're sober and everything's great. But then one day you wake up and you go, oh, I actually can't just go to the pub. Mm. Like, this is now a lifestyle, and then things start hitting you. Mm. And it's just like, whoa, this, like you said, it's not a fucking, no, it's not a walk in the park. Like.
And I think it was important with the book, you know, like, I had to be very careful with the book as well. Don't slip into thinking that you've got the answers here, Sunshine. Do you know what I mean? You are a baby in recovery.
Mm.
And this is a piece of work that discusses your, you know, what got you there and, you know, where you are now. And it seemed, you know, the response has been great and whatever. But I had to be very careful not to slip into believe my own bullshit sort of territory in terms of like, oh, maybe I do have a sus. Because, you know, the beautiful thing about this process has been that like people from every single age group from the country have been reaching out saying, oh, bang, you know, blah, blah, blah. I feel like this, or I've had that experience and I can't believe it. Like sober people, people who are trying to get sober, people who have no intention or need to get sober, but just are relating to certain feelings in the book. And that's so amazing. Like, you know yourself with the podcast and stuff, but ego is fucking dangerous. Like, you know, and just because of my share, like my experience and other people can identify that with that, that's amazing. Like that is unbelievably liberating, hopefully for them and for me. But I can't for a second start thinking, oh, Mark, you're a good man. You're a good guy. Because the only thing that I've done to get sober is do what other sober people have done. I had no discovery. I did not think or arrive on any idea or formula or method to get sober in any capacity. My sole ability to not take a drink today is to look at other alcoholics who've gone before me and copy what they do. That's it. And as you said, like, time in sobriety, like, I operate on a daily basis. It's
yeah,
this 24 hours because I'm, you know, yeah, 2.5 years sober. That matters a damn whenever I walk out of here and some guy just has a cut off me for no reason, says something that gets into my head. That can rattle me. And that, I'm the type of lunatic that somebody could say something to me and I'll go, I'll show you, I'll fucking drink.
Mm.
I'll set my life on fire to prove to you, you know. But that's the thing, like, the vigilance is everything with this. So it's a nice, it's a diary of early recovery. You know, it's not a book on how to stop drinking by any means. But if it helps somebody, like, then my job is done. And I mean, I had to be careful with Darren when we went away after it came out. And I mean, like, it's been such an emotional period because, like, you receive messages from people. And I'm just, like, bro, like, in the most nicest possible way, but, like, crying my eyes out because that sense of connection with other people, nothing bonds anyone, like, the sense of struggle. No matter what, no matter where you're from, no matter what your background is, no matter what age, anything is irrelevant. Like, that sense of we share the same feeling and a feeling of isolation, it's literally just like, oh, well, that's just one step towards the light, isn't it? Like, when you feel connected with somebody else and perfect strangers especially, it's just, yeah, it's amazing.
Mm. Right. Mark, the book is amazing and I'm a big fan of it. I think everybody should get it. And thank you so much for coming in here.
Missus has read it as well, so that's kind of the reason as well why I'm only getting around to it now.
Well, look,
so
she had it before you.
She got her hands on
she
it.
She whipped so it.
She said it was very good as well. No, she was the one when she put it down, she was like, you're going to love this.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mark, we can't let you go without talking about your podcast.
Oh, yes, The Weekly Roast.
Yeah.
Calvin's the biggest fan of the world.
I said to Terry, I said, Mark is doing exactly what I used to do.
Oh, good stuff.
I started this podcast. I used to go on social media and just run amok at people and just yeah, rattle everybody. And mate, I've zero patience. You know this, Terry. I've zero patience with the way the world is going, and you can pick any aspect in society now and I'll just run amok about it.
Mm.
Bleeding people down, let's get dressed videos and all, like, fuck off, annoy me. And you just get to roast it. It's fucking great.
What would you say the average age is if you listen to it?
We disguise
the voices.
Yeah.
So it's completely anonymous. So you get the most perverted. We did a roast on colleagues, right? Wherein it's like, you have to tell us the worst things that your colleagues do. This guy wrote in about saying he sits beside a guy at his desk and there's another person in their little trio corner of the office. And whenever the third person goes up to the loo, the other guy goes over and smells the seat of the office chair. These are people who walk among us. Like, if you think you've got problems, you can listen to the last hour Listen to the last hour of this podcast and go, Jesus, he's a bit of a sloppy enough character. Then go and listen to the Weekly Rose. You go, no, there's nut jobs out there. It's genuine. But again, similar enough with the shared sense of connection in terms of, you know, the liberation from also experiencing hardship. When I listen to the Weekly Rose and the shit that people submit about, like, stuff their friends do or stuff their family, mothers-in-law and, like, in-laws and neighbours and all the rest, you realise, I'm actually not that bad. I'm not that mental.
It has to be middle-aged women, because anyone who writes in, obviously it distorts their voice, but you can kind of gauge roughly that demographic.
Yeah, there's a good cohort of... It's funny, people used to always say, they'd be like, oh, fucking South Dublin, I'd say all your podcasts are just South Dubliners. Something like 12% of the podcast is Dublin.
Yeah.
It's
all the rest of Ireland.
It could have been last week or the week before, but a young one sent in a voice note and she was common as muck. I think I know who it was. It was mad, because sometimes you get someone from Donegal, get a posh accent. And then it's like, yeah, so I was in work the other day and I was like, do I know who that is? But I thoroughly enjoy it anyways, Mark. Ant, you want to plug while you're here?
No, I'm just honestly really grateful to have chatted to you both. You're a gentleman. And I really appreciate you making me feel comfortable. And the Weekly Roast, every Wednesday morning, wherever you get your podcasts. And the book is available online. It's also available in all bookstores around the country. It was a bestseller, by the way.
Good old Bella.
Number one bestseller.
Show her out there.
Yeah.
Still need to change the bio to best-selling author, but...
Yeah. Mark, thanks again for coming into us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Wrap her up, 30.
Yeah.
Take us out, Ed.
Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Till your body attends. Walk it hard and slow. When you finish that...
The hip knocker.